This is Judaism Unbound, episode 65, Investing in the Future. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today in the last of our interviews with Silicon Valley entrepreneurs slash tech people. That is part of our series on the Omer. Next week, we're going to be talking to Zach Bodner again. He's the executive director of the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, which has helped us put together this series of episodes exploring Silicon Valley as a landscape of innovation and potentially as a landscape of Jewish innovation, both directly and sort of by learning from it and applying Silicon Valley ways of thinking to Jewish innovation. Just to remind you that this series is part of our exploration of the Omer, that 7-week period between Passover and the holiday of Shavuot. We are in the mythic story of the exodus of the Hebrews, of the Israelites from Egypt. We're really seeing this as kind of the period in between leaving Egypt, leaving behind what you knew so well and what you might have a sentimental attachment to, even though it wasn't always the greatest, and moving towards something new, something different, but not yet knowing what that new thing is going to be. We're kind of mythically positioning that idea of, well, you finally know at Sinai, the holiday of Shavuot kind of reenacts the giving of the Torah at Sinai. So that's the time when you kind of figure it out. But this period in between is this period where you really don't know, and it's defined by this not knowing. And we're kind of suggesting that that's the state of the Jewish people for the foreseeable future. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually where some of our greatest discoveries were made. And so we're really excited to move into this interview with Oren Ze'ev. He is a Silicon Valley investor. He tends to invest in the early stages of new initiatives. Most famously, he was an early stage investor in Audible.com, actually in its sort of second iteration. But when Audible.com was not doing very well, he was an early investor in it. And then eventually it was sold to Amazon and did very, very well. And it's actually very close to my heart because I do most of my reading through Audible.com. So even though they're not paying us any kind of sponsorship here, I am really excited to share with you that if you enjoy podcasts, you'll really enjoy reading through Audible.com. So I was really excited to be able to talk to the early investor in Audible.com. In addition to Audible, Oren Ze'ev has invested in a lot of really, really successful early stage companies. Most recently, he's been investing in the website House, HOUZZ.com, which helps people think about the decoration, the design of their homes. And he is also an investor in a company called Tipalti, which we'll talk about in the episode. And we thought that really talking to a Silicon Valley investor, particularly one who invests in the early stages of new ideas, would be really helpful at this stage of our podcast and at this stage of Jewish history, because what we think we're really looking at is these kind of new, unproven ideas. One of them is probably the one that's going to really hit, but we don't know which one it's going to be. We don't know how to know. We don't know how to measure. And we thought it would be really helpful to talk to somebody who's investments are in companies that are at a similar stage. So we're really excited to share this interview with Oren Ze'ev with you.
Yeah, and this is Lex speaking, and I just wanted to remind folks, this is another episode that unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your vantage point, I will not be playing too much of a vocal role. I wasn't there in Silicon Valley with Dan on his trip out there, so I wasn't able to be there in person. But I did listen thoroughly and think that you're in for an interesting time. So I hope that you will pay attention close, send us your questions, thoughts, concerns, ideas, and I'll be back at the outro, at the conclusion to wave goodbye.
Well, Lex, it'll be great to have you back fully next week. And in the meantime, I'm really excited to share this interview that I did with Oren Ze'ev.
Okay, Oren, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's really great to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So what we wanted to talk about today with you is, as we think about how to think differently about Judaism and how to think differently about trying new experiments out in Judaism, we're really interested in kind of getting into the mind of a Silicon Valley investor and understanding what are you looking for when you see an early stage idea, and you're deciding whether it makes sense to pursue it further.
The very first thing is the people who pitch the idea. It may sound like a cliche, but it really is true. You're backing people. And the idea is, it's important, it's a good idea, but it's 1% of the of what it takes to be successful. Really, the first question, assuming that the idea doesn't already have early traction in the market, assuming that it's pre-traction, pre any proof points from the market, then the first thing and the most important thing is the credibility of the founders. By credibility, I don't mean if you believe them or not. I mean if you believe in them. So I always ask myself, first and foremost, not what am I backing, but who am I backing? Second thing that I ask myself is there a clear value proposition to the customers, to the users? And my, you know, almost my test is, it really has to be simple and straightforward. It really has to be something that not only can I tell my wife at dinner, over dinner, and within a minute she'll understand. I should be able to tell my kids and they'll understand. And I should even be able to tell my grandma if she were alive, and she would understand. So that's number two, very clear value proposition. It has to be something that's a must have as opposed to a nice to have. It has to be something that is a 10x improvement over what they're doing now versus a 20% improvement, because we are swamped with, all of us, with things that demand our attention. Last thing, which is probably unrelated to what you're looking for, but I always look for my own edge. So I always look, why do the founders want the money from me and no one else? What's special about me in this situation? And usually the answer is because because a combination of we have a prior relationship, they trust me, they think I can help them, I have domain expertise that's relevant, I can make things happen for them. So I like to be special, I like to be their first choice. If I think I'm one of five or six or seven, it's a little bit like marriage. You know, you want the person you're going to marry, you want her to want to marry you. And not just, oh, I want to marry someone and you're as good as anyone else. So the analogy with marriage, actually, I see all the time. Except it's hard to get a divorce.
Well, it's interesting that you make the analogy to marriage on another level. Something that we've talked about on our podcast is this. And I think I read something about you that is relevant to this. So I hope that's true. Is that when you get married and then you say, well, how are we going to grow this company, right? It's about having children. And the child is a baby that basically doesn't do anything for quite a long period of time. And even after that, it's mostly doing annoying things and, you know, harming your house and making you wake up in the middle of the night and everything. But you have this sense that, you know, one day this is going to be something valuable and, you know, and there's value along the way. But, you know, you kind of, I guess the analogy that I'm trying to make is you don't go to scale for a long, long time. And one of the things that I read about you that I thought was really interesting was that, you know, your investment is, I think that's sort of at the pre-scale period. And that's what I'm thinking about in terms of some of this Jewish innovation that we're talking about, because I think that especially when we're talking about, you know, not just wanting to be another player in the market where there's 20 other players and you're maybe a little better, but saying, no, we're really thinking about the people that are not involved at all in that stuff. And can we create something new that would be valuable there? And then, of course, it's going to be the market leader because it's the only thing that those people are really getting excited about. How do we do that? And I think that my sense of what's gone on in the Jewish world over the last, let's say, 10, 15 years since Jewish innovation has even been a thing, it gets to the stage of some funder getting excited about it that has the funding to actually make a big difference. The push seems always to be go to scale, you know, and my critique of that is that I've seen a lot of sort of half-baked Jewish ideas taken to scale, and then either they end up having to be acquired by a larger organization because they're at a scale that they're not sustainable, or they just fail. And I look around me at some of the people that are doing amazing projects out there but don't yet have a lot of funding. I say, what should they do? Because what they really need is, let's say, 5 more years to fully develop their thing.
One of the best words of advice that I've ever heard, and since I heard it, I I adopted it and I use it all the time, is think big, start small, and move fast. But move fast only once you nailed it. Before you fully nailed it, then if you move fast, you're going to move fast with half-baked idea and you're going to run out of money. So typically when startups ask me, how fast should I go? First of all, the move fast piece is much more relevant to startups to the competitive for-profit world than not-for-profit. Because in not-for-profit, your biggest issue is not that a competitor is going to steal your thunder. But in the for-profit world, there's such a huge discrepancy between the value of such a huge gap between the value of the market leader and the number two or number three, that it's all about attaining market leadership. That's why moving fast is very important. Sometimes there is tension. How fast should you go when you're not full? And typically, so the advice that I give startups is, works for startups, but it's even more true in your case, because the move fast is less important. You want to move fast once you really nailed it. But if you do it before, you go too fast before, you're going to run in the wrong direction and you're going to run out of money. And by the way, the analogy that I use is, which might resonate with you as well, actually, is when you are in an area that you don't know, let's say a town you're not from that town. And let's assume it's pre-GPS and pre-navigation. Because I started to use this example before before navigation was ubiquitous. And you're looking for the right turn, the right street to turn on, or the right exit. You're not gonna go 60 miles per hour. You're gonna miss the turn, and you're gonna run out of gas. You're gonna go at 20, 25 miles per hour. Maybe you're gonna stop. Maybe you're gonna go a little bit back. Try this, try that, until you found the exit to the freeway, the one that you want. Once you're there, just make sure the gas tank is full and hit the metal to the pedal. That's the analogy. So in the early stages, when you're still, working to refine the idea, and that's true for for-profit, it's true for not-for-profit, just the same, go slow. Go back even. Go in reverse. From time to time. Many big thinkers have a hard time starting small. And almost always, when someone thinks big and starts big, almost always they fail. Because these ideas need time to be fully baked. And I can give many examples from the business world. And I'm sure for the not-for-profit world as well.
You know, what I'm wondering about in the not-for-profit world, to some extent, whether the personalities are reversed in the sense that it's the funders who want to go big too quickly, right? And the entrepreneur actually would be okay being small, but the pressure, at least this is my experience and what I hear from others, but the pressure is to say how big, how fast, and that's coming from the funder. And so that's why it's so interesting to me to hear.
I agree, but it's true for the for-profit world as well. Usually the funders who are more removed from the day, they don't necessarily fully grasp and understand the challenges. They're not as close to the trenches as the entrepreneur, whether it's for-profit or social entrepreneur. Yeah, they drive, they push the founder. They drive, and they expect him to or her to meet unrealistic expectations. And many times it ruins a company that could otherwise be successful. So I think part of it, which is a luxury, is to choose your funders well. If you can't do that, that the other option is to have enough confidence and balls to not to tell the funders what the funders want to hear, but tell the funder, be authentic with the funders. I think the problem is that many times, at the end of the day, any intelligent funder will not insist on the entrepreneur doing something that the entrepreneur, doesn't believe in. Even if I'm 100% convinced that I'm right and the entrepreneur is wrong about something, I would still not want them to take my route and not theirs, because I would prefer that they make their mistakes and not mine. And I prefer that whatever route they take, they believe in it, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If they don't believe in something, they did it just because I forced them to do it or press them to do it, then it's almost like they're trying to prove me wrong. So you know what, we tried and you're, you know. Now, it's not true for every funder in both worlds, and some people have bigger egos and they think they know better. I think that as an entrepreneur, whether social entrepreneur or not, frankly, you want to stay away from funders who have big egos. You don't want the personalities that you see in Shark Tank. And so that's number one. You want to choose well. And you want to, and you also want to be very authentic and not just tell the funders what they want to hear, but just be open with them and honest with them. Now, the thing is that sometimes if you don't have the right person, it will backfire. The way I operate, but obviously it's not everyone is that operates like that, is I'm always a safe environment for the entrepreneur because I'm never going to force them to do, even if I'm 100% convinced of something, I'm never going to force them to go my way. To me, it's clear who's working for whom. Although it's my money, I'm working for them, not the other way around. Which is a little bit goes against traditional understanding of ownership, right? Usually, I'm the owner, someone else is the employee. No. At least in the world that I come from, the founder owns the company. By the way, that doesn't matter. Even if they only own 10% of the company, it doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, it's their company, and they've given the privilege to back them, and I need to justify that this confidence. So I'm always going to go with it. I'll tell them what I think. I'll give them input. I'll give them feedback. But at the end of the day, if the founder tells me, okay, I heard you. I understand where you're coming from. I understand. But after I've really thought about it and maybe got input from several directions, here is what I think we should do. It could be move faster, it could be move slower, it could be mean sell, it could mean one strategy versus another. I always say, go for it. I'll never come back a year later or 6 months later and say, I told you so, if they happen to be wrong. The big advantage of this approach, other than the fact that many times they do know better, because they're just closer to the trenches. But other than that fact, there's a huge advantage in the founder knowing that I'm a safe environment because they can really share everything. If I'm not a safe environment, they can't share everything. So they will spin stuff with me. I'm not going to get the real story. They'll have an agenda, what they're trying to convince me, and they'll tell me the facts that support whatever they're trying to convince me because they don't need to convince me. Because from day one, I say, okay, let's talk about it, but it's your decision. You know, I'm here to help you decide, but it's your decision. The whole nature of conversation changes. So I think that's a healthy relationship, both in the for-profit and not-for-profit. I don't see any difference. Now, it takes confidence. It takes certain maturity on both sides. It takes two to tango, because it's not just up to you. It's also up to the other side. You can't be open with them because they're using it against you. What can you do? So all I can say is try to, and it's a luxury. I realize that usually you take money where you get it, but try to get, but it is a marriage. You can't get rid of them. You know, if you take money from a funder, actually in the not-for-profit world, it's different because they don't buy equity. So they give this year, next year they might not give, so, and you might go separate ways and there's no ownership. So maybe it's a little bit different in the not-for-profit, but in the for-profit world, there is no, you took from the wrong person. You may have destroyed your company. You may have, you may have wasted a great idea and 5 years of your life.
I think that's not so dissimilar in the nonprofit world. I mean, it's maybe for slightly different reasons, but I think that if you choose the wrong funder early on, it has similarly deleterious effects. But here's my question that comes from that. If you're looking at a situation where, you've got this undefined market, and I mean, I'm not asking this hypothetically. I guess I'm asking you for, practically how you address this because you're saying the idea, the product market fit comes later, right? So when somebody comes to you with the idea, they may not have it. But if they don't, how do you?
Oh, and look, and I think about the idea, and it has to make sense. Maybe it's not proven,
right?
But it has to make sense to me.
So, can you give me an example of a time when that happened, when the idea wasn't baked yet, but you invested?
I'll give you two examples. One recent, one less recent. I'll start with the less recent. A few years ago, in that case, by the way, I actually was also the co-founder, not just the investor. A few years ago, I saw one of my companies had many thousands of small websites that they needed to pay. And the actual payment process was a huge pain for a number of reasons. It was manual. It was consuming resources, human resources. It was full of mistakes. And they didn't want to automate it because it was too much of an investment. So they looked for a third party to outsource this, the actual payment. And what made it complex was not just that there were thousands of payees, it was also there was very global. So it was like pay in Russia, pay in Bangladesh, and pay here, pay there. And they couldn't find anyone who was offering it as a service. And that gave me the idea that there must be other companies that have the same pain. Why not try to build a service that addresses this pain? And I verified it to the extent that I could. I talked to 6 or 7 or 8 companies that I thought had the similar pain, and they, to varying degrees, they confirmed it. Some were, you know, some talked about it as, some were very excited, some less so, some maybe nice to have, maybe, you know, not real pain. But it made the threshold that got me. And then I convinced a friend of mine to build it, and that's one company. We call it Ipalti.
I've got it, or I've taken care of it. Right?
Exactly. I took care of it, yeah. Uh-huh. And right now it looks like a great success. Mm. A few years later. Another one which looks like an early success as well, more recent one, about a year and a half ago, two people that I know, think very highly of, in fact, they even backed them before, and they were successful, had been successful in a small way before, told me about this idea. They wanted to build an app to book travel for companies, for employees of companies. The current existing solutions really, really suck. That was part of the premise. Everyone hates them. The employees hate them, and the CFOs hate them. But there's another thing that's really interesting. Employees do not treat corporate money the same way they treat their own. Mm-hmm. They optimize for different things. They're not going to wake an hour earlier to take a cheaper flight. And they're not going to, you know, if the policy of the company allows them to pay $300 per night for the hotel, they're not going to make an effort to find a hotel for $150, right? Which they would have if it was their money. So their idea was, why don't we have built-in rewards for employees to incentivize them to make choices that would save company money? Not try to take away choices from employees. Not tell them, oh, you can't stay at $300, you can only stay at $150. Allow them to do whatever they like within the existing policy of the company. But if they take the $150 instead of $300, they get some of it back in the form of points that are redeemable into something that's equivalent to cash. So really a way for the CFO to incentivize and share the savings with the employee. I love the idea. Now, could we validate it at that point? You know, not really. I mean, yeah, I asked a few CFOs. They say, yeah, it sounds good. Something sounds good. Sounds interesting. Some were more skeptical. Some had other things to say. But the combination of people that I trusted, but it was just an idea at that point. Combination of people that I trusted and an idea that I really, really liked. I liked the alignment of interest. I liked the fact that it was a very big market, innovative approach, a lot of value to the company and the employees, by the way. And so that was a good reason for me to back them. It's called Trip Actions. There, you know, it was a year and a half ago. Today, a year and a half later, they have a beautiful product. They have dozens of customers. They're growing very, very fast. And to me, it looks like it's something that can be very big and can really redefine business travel.
I'm trying to just think about how do we map some of these questions onto the kind of work that we're doing in the Jewish world. And I don't think it's hard at all. In fact, you know, the example that I give a lot when I make presentations and I talk about using business ideas and applying them to Judaism, people say, well, it's not a business, it's different. You know, and I say, well, Clayton Christensen wrote in The Innovator's Dilemma that he studied disk drives not because he's so interested in disk drives, but because disk drives change very quickly. The technological changes are very fast. So it's kind of like the fruit flies of business, you know, and in a way, I think business is kind of like the fruit flies of cultural change, right? So it's a question of, you know, these processes may be slower, they may be different.
I think some things are very similar, mm-hmm. and some things are less, more challenging. For example, when I look at a not-for-profit, so here's the things that are similar in the way I look at it. First of all, I first and foremost look at the person versus the cause, because mm-hmm. there are many good causes.
Yeah,
many good causes I can support and can be, you know, get convinced to support. The question is, what do you think about the execution capabilities of the person? Am I comfortable backing that person? Do I believe in that person? So that's something that's very, very similar. Second thing is, I try to make a difference. I try to move the needle. That's true in both cases. So I would rather choose a limited number of causes and go all in both cases, for profit and not for profit, as opposed to spread myself too thin. One thing that's easier in the not-for-profit world is that, you know, competition is not an issue. Yeah. And if anything, if the competition is successful, if someone is doing what you're trying to do and they're doing it well, great. You know, you accomplished what you wanted. But that's never the issue. So that's something that's easier. The one thing that I find harder is to really know, to measure the return. Mm-hmm. It's much less straightforward. And I know there are all sorts of methodologies, etc. How do we measure return, etc. And people try to do it and try to address it. It's much more straightforward in the business right. world. You know, I look at revenues, I look at profits, I look at all sorts of metrics. It's very, very simple.
Right.
Not for profit, much more subjective, much more much more subject to the storytelling abilities of the of the social entrepreneur, let's call it. Much more subjective, much harder. You know, I just talked about, you know, there is some cause in Israel that we support, again, in a pretty big way relatively. And we love the guy and we think he's doing a great job, and I think he is. I'm not saying he's not. But I'm really only relying on what it tells me, and it's not verifiable too much, right? At least not now. And you know what? And I can't even tell him to put huge amount of resources on the measuring of all sorts of things that may or may not map to. So that's the one thing that I think is so much harder in the not-for-profit world. The other thing that I find more challenging in the not-for-profit world is that natural selection works much better in the business world. Hmm. Because at the end of the day, companies that run out of money. And to not run out of money, they have to either be profitable or be able to continuously convince investors that they will become profitable. Hmm. Not always an easy task. In the not-for-profit world, there is actually, I don't see a direct correlation always between how effective the organization is and how effective they are in fundraising. Because it's really two different things. The fundraising is dependent on how well the person who fundraises is networked and how well they tell the story and make it emotional and, you know, whatever. And maybe to some extent also, to what extent the donors identify naturally with the cause, and to what extent it enhances the feeling of the self-image of the donors. And finally, I think also to what extent the donors feel that they are, thanks to the fact that they're donors, they're part of some special club and maybe have access to people, etc. All these things have nothing to do with how good a job that organization is doing. Right. Nothing. And there's not a clear feedback. Now, in the business world, you don't do well, you're not serving your customers well, it will reflect itself in the numbers. It will impact your ability to raise money.
Absolutely. And I think it's even harder in the innovation space of nonprofits, because at least a large established organization has some metrics that they've developed. I mean, the thing that I'm sort of trying to probe at here is that sort of product market fit question when you're talking about a new approach in the nonprofit world. Particularly, I mean, I think it's doubly hard in what we're talking about in the Jewish world today, because it's not only a new approach, it's potentially a new value proposition in the first place, right? A new way of thinking about what Judaism is, you know? And so, in a way, though, what I'm intrigued by is the way that you describe sort of the patience that you have to allow the entrepreneur to sort of figure that out over a course of time. That said, your patience, I would imagine, is a product of it's two things. It's finite, and it's because you continue to believe. Your patience probably runs out when you no longer believe that this is going to produce
a return.
I'm
still going to be, you know, supportive and everything and positive, but I'm just not going to put new money.
Right.
And if I don't put more money, probably it means that the company's going to die.
Right.
Yeah, that happens.
But the question in the nonprofit world to me is that most likely these processes are going to take longer than they would in the for-profit world. The measures are going to be different, harder to see, et cetera. At the same time, if the result is, which I think it often is, that the person who is thinking about this from a kind of business thinking mindset will say, well, then I will invest in the long-standing organization, because at least over there, I know how to judge if I'm making an impact.
Yeah, on the other hand, in the bigger, well-established organization, it's harder for me to move the needle. Okay, so that's a reason to actually invest in something new. There is less leverage, because here, if I'm successful, presumably it will. And also, I think it would be a mistake, despite the challenges that I just talked about, I think it would be a mistake to say, okay, I only invest if I can really measure the ROI, etc. Because it will, by definition, if everyone thought like that, then some areas where it's easier to define will be overfunded, and areas that are harder to define by definition, because it's like more subtle, it's more qualitative, it's more subjective, it will be underfunded. So I think that for the not-for-profit world, it is a challenge, but you know, you also have to live with. So for example, I continue to to back this social entrepreneur, and I think that we're doing something really, really important, even if I can't exactly define a very, very clear ROI. I'm talking about it as a challenge, but I think it would be a mistake to say, okay, so in that case, I don't do anything that's...
I guess just to play out one more thing about the approach that you take in partnering with the companies that you invest in, how you might think about that vis-a-vis a relationship between a nonprofit entrepreneur and a funder at that early stage.
Same.
Can you say more?
Really? I mean, I have a few organizations where I'm there. Same. Assuming that, so I don't make a distinction. You know, I can be the main backer in the for-profit, and I can be the main backer in not-for-profit. And in that case, I'm the first phone call of the founder. I'm the safe environment. I'm the one that he can really, really. Show me what's going on, etc., and I'm a safe environment. Although I'm a safer environment in the in both cases, I can decide to stop giving money. So it's not totally true that I'm totally safe. But if I'm a small investor in a company, I'm not on the board, that's equivalent to being a smaller backer. So I'm not the first. And maybe I get an update once a year. So from that perspective, I don't see a big difference. I really don't. I think our job is, as I said, to me, and that's, I think it differs from people most donors, I think, that's my observation, that most people being philanthropic and don't have my background of being an investor, even if they were entrepreneurs and themselves, I think give much more weight to the cause and their emotional connection to the cause, and much less weight to the execution, to the who they're backing. It's not even the first question that they ask, who am I backing? But I remember someone pitching some idea to my wife and me that really had a very, very close connection to that idea. So after the meeting, my wife asked me what I thought, and I said, no way, and she was surprised because she felt the connection to the idea. And I told him, listen, I love the idea. I think what you know, I think it could be great. I just don't see this person being able to execute or someone I want to back. And she understood it. Okay, but their natural intuition was not even to, it was now she thinks about it because she learned from it, but not even to think. So I think that the one thing I think distinguishes me a little bit that the first question I look at is that as opposed to the the cause, because the cause you know how do you compare apples? It's apples and oranges, and they're all good. So if I find someone that I really like, I want to spend time with, I think she's great, even if I have nothing. Even if I have a fairly weak connection to the cause, I would rather back her because I see this backing her as opposed to backing the ideas. Yeah, I have such example of something also in Israel. Someone who literally just feeds the hungry in a certain town in Israel. And these are the lowest of the lowest. And I really have nothing in common with this community, right? It's not my community. The old religious, for example, you know, it's really not my tribe. And also, it doesn't build on my strengths. There's no business involved, you know, it's not even those usually companies, not-for-profit like to tell a story how they invest. They use the word invest, and then they have an exit strategy, or they're able to pull someone from poverty and, you know, don't give them fish, give them... a net, or whatever yeah. The expression goes. In this case, it's not even that, you know. It's really. So why am I backing them? It's against every. Why? Because I think that person. I met that person, and I felt that the work that she's doing is unbelievable. It's what probably Mother Teresa wanted people to think she is. She's the real deal. Well, you know, doesn't have the PR of Mother Teresa, but. It's amazing. And then the execution capability is also amazing. And I say, okay, every dollar that I give her is pure, you know, I know there's no waste. I know that it's so leveraged, you know. So here's an example to, I'm putting so much more weight on the person who runs the not-for-profit and who I'm backing than on the idea. Now, in the business world, I want both.
In closing, could you just on the subject of Audible, because it's dear to my heart and it's relevant to the work that we're doing with audio production, can you just say a little bit about what you saw there as that unmet opportunity?
Look, I think I just got lucky, because I don't think I was that clairvoyant. I think I got lucky, and you know, and I was enough of an independent thinker at the time. I what I saw there is a company that had raised tons of money, burned it. Because their problem was that they were 5 or 6 years too early. So they were running too fast when the market wasn't there. That's exactly what happened. And in 99, they went public, all based on hype. And when I met him, it was in 2003, it was the public stock had collapsed, imploded. It was like a penny stock. It was in the pink sheet. It was delisted from the stock market. Kind of like an orphan. There were no VCs anymore because they got... And it was a company that had burned $100 million and had very little to show for. And he had the last million. He raised like $80 million when he went public, and he raised a few tens before, and he had like the last $1 million. It was still not profitable. However, by that time, I think all the conditions why he wasn't successful before were met. Because the iPod... was launched a few months earlier and was starting to gain traction. So suddenly, the big problem, and broadband was already pretty prevalent, but the big thing was the... So I think that what I saw that others look at it and say, oh, this company's never going to make it. You know, they always promise, they always under-deliver, they always over-promise, oh, this guy's not a CEO. You know, this guy is such a disappointment, he's burned so much money, they're never going to make it. I was lucky that I didn't have all this baggage. And I looked at it fresh eyes and said, you know, forget what happened in the past. Right now I'm looking at this company, it has all the ingredients. And all the ingredients are there. They're just on the cusp of taking off. And luckily I was right. It took a month after I invested, they closed a very significant deal with Apple. And they really rode the adoption curve of the iPod and later the iPhone and later Android. But so I just had the best timing, and I wasn't part of the... And the other thing, I think I wasn't part of the herd mentality. I just arrived from Israel a year earlier. I wasn't yet, I was ignorant enough not to know about all the reasons why this company would never make it. And that's why I was able to look at it with more objectively, with fresh eyes. Okay, well, you know, forget what happened in the past. Now everything is ripe and everything is ready. And this is the time. And it was very quick, by the way. As I said, a month later, the deal and the numbers started to take off. And 14 months later, we took it public again at 17 times my cost.
Wow.
It was 17x in 14 months, which is really, really rare. Yeah. So that was the story.
Well, that's a fascinating story, and it's really amazing to hear the origin story of something I really love. So I want to thank you personally for everything that you did to make Audible.com the incredible resource that it has been in my life over the last decade. And I want to really thank you for spending this time with us today, Oren. It was really an education in how investors think. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Lex back again. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, we want to close with a request for you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with either a one-time donation or a monthly recurring donation. And you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. This has been week 5 of the Omer and Judaism Unbound.